Good morning. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I'm calling the first remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. Welcome, everyone. We're going to start with the CLA taking the roll to determine which members are present. When you hear your name, please indicate that you're here by saying present.
Vice Chair Keeler?
Keeler, present.
New Brindley?
New Brindley, present.
Davids?
Davids, present.
Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Hollins?
Hollins, present.
Hornstein?
Hornstein, present.
Howard? Howard? Cagle?
Cagle, present.
Petersburg?
Petersburg, present.
Ryer?
Ryer, present.
And Chair Gomez?
Gomez, present. There's a quorum present, clerk?
Correct.
Thank you. So this being our first meeting, we don't have any minutes to adopt today, so we're kind of going to jump right in. The Preventing Homelessness Committee is new this year, and I'm very thankful to the speaker for creating it and for her commitment to this issue. You know, and when I saw the lineup, when I saw the DFL and GOP membership on this committee, I was really excited. You know, I know that all of us here across any differences in experience and differences in political ideology have a shared heart for this work and for the people in our communities and across the state who are experiencing homelessness and don't have a safe and stable place to sleep tonight. You know, we're the right group of people to be taking this work on, and I'm really grateful to each of you for being in it with me. I think it was Kathy Tenbrook or someone on her team that talked about how in this way, COVID made a lot of people in this highly mobile population stop right where they were. And in this time, in the last year, homelessness and especially unsheltered homelessness has been made visible in a way that's new to a lot of us. And the challenges of serving this population has really been heightened in a lot of ways due to the COVID restrictions. This work is really hard. It is a most visible manifestation or like an outcome of the ways that we have failed one another in a lot of respects. It's a crisis that exists at the intersection of many crises. You know, the reality of homelessness is at a nexus of housing supply and affordability, racialized economic inequality, systemic racial inequality, the realities of intergenerational trauma, the failures of our healthcare systems, our mental health and substance use disorder systems, and, you know, so many other kind of challenges that people in our communities are facing. There are specific challenges facing, you know, communities in greater Minnesota that sometimes lack the emergency shelter infrastructure that we have here in the metro, but still have, you know, issues related to homelessness happening in their communities. You know, veterans, the LGBTQ community, tribal communities, the formerly incarcerated, victims of domestic violence, youth, elders, all face specific challenges related to this issue. A couple of weeks ago, I met with the St. Paul Deputy Mayor, Jamie Tincher, who was, I think she was Mark Dayton's chief of staff. And, you know, our core cities really have been dealing, you know, with unsheltered homelessness and encampments in really intensive ways over the last year because of CDC guidelines about not displacing encampments during the COVID crisis. And, you know, so Jamie, our Deputy Mayor Tincher is a very, you know, she's like a seasoned person in policy. And we had this really great conversation, a long conversation, and she shared her work, the work that St. Paul's doing with me. And she said, this is the most complicated public policy issue that I've ever had to tackle in my life. And which made me feel good because I was like, okay, maybe it's not just me, right? Like, here's this person who has this really vast experience, and she too is just really, you know, aware of the kind of unique challenges and the unique complication and the unique intersections that we see in this issue. You know, there are so many good people, so many good organizations, so many people of goodwill working on this issue. I think we have really incredible people working on this at the state, local, county levels in government. We have an incredible advocacy and direct service community. We have so many faith communities and so many individual kind of groups of people in our, you know, across the state who are coming together to tackle this issue. My impression has been that, you know, we need to bring some kind of coordination and more specific accountability around who's responsible for what at what level of government and how we're kind of like all moving in the same direction. And I'm really hopeful that we can, that this group of people, this group of legislators can provide some of that opportunity for us to try to move in the same direction so that we really are bringing together all of these incredible people of goodwill who are doing this work kind of in silos and figure out how to get kind of coordinated and moving together. Just a couple of final things, you know, I think that a lot of us, you know, certainly a lot of us in the legislature, we're disconnected from this issue in a kind of personal way. You know, a lot of us don't have the opportunity to interact with people who've experienced homelessness or people who are experiencing homelessness, and especially unsheltered homelessness. And, you know, I really believe firmly that we're people who are impacted by issues are the best experts on their own lives. And so I'm really committed to us as a group hearing from people who have or are currently experiencing homelessness, to like centering their voices and trying to help our systems be more responsive to their actual needs based on what they're telling us, not on our preconceived notions of what that is. You know, as we all know, there are great costs to us, human and material costs to us not dealing with this issue. You know, I think of it as like we pay now or we pay later. We help people get stably housed and safely housed now, or we pay for it in ER visits, cost to our education system, incarceration, and just the human tragedy of, you know, people not having this safe kind of basis on which to build their lives, which is what we're all here to do. Like all of us, regardless of where we come from, you know, we're here in the Minnesota legislature to make people's lives better. You don't do this if you don't believe in that ethic, you know? And so it's a beautiful day out today. I think it's like 40 degrees. It's gonna be 30 degrees tonight. But next week we're gonna be in the low single digits at night. And there are people across the state who don't have a place to go. Last night there were hundreds of people who sought refuge on Metro Transit trains. And are riding those back and forth. So, you know, as we do this work together, as we do this hard work together, I just want us to all remember them, you know, and that this is not remote from people's lives, that this is directly impacting people who are all beloved members of our communities, somebody's child and somebody's loved one. And so I really thank you for being here with me, and I'm looking forward to this work with you all. As for the committee today, we're gonna hear member introductions and an overview from the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. Next week, we're going to hear testimony from advocates and from Minnesotans facing unsheltered homelessness themselves. To open our first meeting, we've set aside a little bit of time for each of our members to share their own experience with homelessness and help us get a taste for how this issue impacts your home community. So I've asked each of you to come ready to reflect on this and to share as we begin to prepare for the work ahead of us this session. So I'd ask each person to share their name and their district or role on the committee and a personal reflection. Just as a note about time, we have as I said, the presentation from the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, and we have at least two members of the community who signed up to speak. So I'd ask you to keep your initial reflection and intro to, like, you know, 2 to 3 minutes so we can fit everyone in, knowing that we're going to have a lot more time to get to know each other as we move forward. So first, I'm really thrilled to have Representative Heather Keeler as the vice chair of this committee and a really important part of the leadership of this committee. And so I'd like to ask her to set it off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Heather Keeler from District 4A, which is Moorhead and Oakport Township. And so I really come to the table understanding Greater Minnesota and Border City, Minnesota. I think Representative or Chair Gomez and I have talked a lot about the differences in what homelessness looks like, whether it's in St. Paul, Minneapolis, or what it looks like out in rural, smaller, Greater Minnesota. I have worked many years in education. Most of that was in Indian education. And so my personal connection is that I've seen our kids within a weekend end up on a street. I know that often we talk about so many Americans are one paycheck away from being homeless. And I think in the pandemic in the last year, a lot of us have experienced that in ways that we never thought that we would. But it breaks my heart to see our kids not show up on Monday morning at school because they don't know where their new bus goes, that they're at our shelters. And then they're exposed to things that are really dangerous. A lot of people talk about it, but we don't really bring it to the forefront that one of my biggest fears is the human trafficking and abuse that happens to our youth in some of these spaces. But my goal here is to really prevent homelessness. You know, it's one thing to create shelters and to do things, but I want to look at those steps and those barriers that have happened leading up to this moment. I come from 7 generations of veterans, and so to see some of our veterans on the street after they served our country and put their life on the line for us, I think that they deserve more, they deserve better from us, and we have to step up to really be a voice for everybody. I'm so glad to be here. I'm looking forward to working with all of you. This is very much an issue that impacts every single one of our communities. Not everybody's on the street. A lot of people are doubled up, tripled up, or even quadrupled up, especially right now. People are just looking for warm, safe spaces to stay. It's a privilege for us that we all got up this morning and most likely we're able to brush our teeth, wash our hair, and do that all under the safety of a warm roof. And so let's keep in mind that we have to work together to really change the path and change our next generation when it comes to this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Keeler. Next, Representative Ann New Brindley, we're so pleased to have her as our GOP lead. She's the Deputy Minority Leader. And if you could share a couple minutes of thoughts with us, Representative New Brindley.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Gomez, first of all. You know, I'm Representative Ann New Brindley. I represent most of Chisago County. So the communities of Taylor's Falls, Wyoming, North Branch, and lots of things in between. You know, it's interesting as we talk about the issue of homelessness, as you said, this is one of those issues, I think, like addiction and mental health issues that really touch everyone. I think we all, certainly I have experiences, not with myself, but with very close family members who have experienced homelessness. And as you said, this is the intersection of lots of different things. And I know for loved ones in my life that homelessness included addiction, as it does for so many. So I appreciate your approach to this committee and what we're hearing so far. I appreciate the idea that we'll be listening to these folks and hearing. What I really want to know is what is working and what is not working, because I believe that there are things we're doing right, but there are also many ways in which we're spinning wheels and we're not really helping people with what we're doing. And we need to get to the bottom of that. How do we really help people? Fortunately for those loved ones in my life, they have found reprieve and are living sober and it's a privilege for me to help house them. And it's interesting when we talk about housing of the homeless and when we look at all of these related issues, I know that one issue that's been very difficult for folks that I know. And in fact, this was also true, you know, I was at the dedication of a veterans home in North St. Paul last year. And the folks there talked about this as well, that it's really, really difficult that even when folks have gotten themselves in a position where they are emotionally stable, they have at least for the time conquered addiction, these things, it's still really difficult to find suitable housing. Sometimes they can find housing, but it is housing that puts them back in a precarious position. So there are a lot of related issues here. And I feel like every session there seems to be a committee that I serve on where it's an emotionally weighty committee. And I think this is it for me for this session, but I look forward to it and I look forward to the work. So thank you, Chair Gomez.
Thank you so much, Representative New Brindley. Next, Representative Greg Davids.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Greg Davids, District 20B, Fillmore and Houston Counties. I border Iowa and I border Wisconsin, so I have a distinct set of issues being in competition with them daily and generally losing. So I would like to change that around, and I'm looking forward to serving on your committee.
Thank you so much, Representative Davids. Rep Heinrich.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Representative John Heinrich from the City of Anoka. Represent the cities of Anoka and Ramsey, which is District 35A. Anoka is the county seat, the city of Anoka for Anoka County. So we have a lot of different services and programs in Anoka. I just wanted to list off of a few in the district that I represent. Hope for Youth, great organization, Stepping Stone Emergency Housing, Anoka Community Mission, and Haven for Heroes, Healing Vets. Place for vets to come and get back into life after service, and a lot of them come off the streets as well. I actually had a chance yesterday to chat with a lady named Delicia. Maybe some of you will get a chance to chat with her, but she's an employee at Stepping Stone Emergency Housing in Anoka, and she was homeless. She told her story about living in a car, single mother. And now she's actually, she's found some success and able to get on her feet, and she's paying it back or paying it forward, so to speak, and actually working as a life skills mentor and coach at Stepping Stone Emergency Housing. And so something like that brings me a lot of joy to see people that have moved from one spot to another, and then they go back because they understand they have a story they can share and they can really help people. Some of the pillars that I understand, that's certainly not an exhaustive list or anything, but some of the pillars that I understand of ways to prevent homelessness is a couple main things, statistically, leading indicators, like stuff like finish high school, don't have kids out of wedlock, get a job. I mean, those are, again, not an exhaustive list, but some basic things. And I think all of us need to start really looking at some of the very root issues of homelessness. Like I said, it's not an exhaustive list, but some of the leading indicators, those are them, you know, stuff like, you know, try to get a job isn't an easy one for a lot of people. So sometimes easier said than done. But when you look at those indicators, those are some things that have helped prevent poverty in the past. So again, thank you, Madam Chair, and really will enjoy being a part of this committee. And I know we can do some good work for our homeless population here in our state.
Thank you so much, Representative Heinrich. Sounds like Alicia maybe should come and present to our committee at some point, so we'll connect about that. Representative Athena Hollins.
My internet is unstable. Am I next?
Yeah, you are, Representative Hollins. Thank you.
Sorry, I can't. Everything's freezing. My name is Athena Hollins. I'm the representative for District 66B in St. Paul. That's sort of the northern part of the city. Neighborhoods, if you're familiar with them, are Payne Phelan, north end of St. Paul, and also Como Park. I am really excited to be a part of this committee and to be working on this issue. It's very near and dear to my heart, and it's especially important to folks in my area, as we've seen more homelessness and homeless encampments in the city of St. Paul. I know that we have gone from approximately 19 homeless individuals or unsheltered individuals in the city to, you know, an explosion of over 200 during this COVID-19 pandemic. And I've been in communication with Deputy Mayor Tincher, as well as Mitra Jalali and Nelsie Yang, my city council members in my district, and Amy Brenmullen, about what we can do to be as supportive as possible and how we can address this effectively. And I'm really excited about this group in particular, because it's not something that I think we should, Representative Keeler was saying, I don't think it's just reactionary. It's not something where we're just reacting to what happens. We need to be thinking about down the line how we're going to address this and proactively ensure that individuals don't end up homeless. And that is one of my top priorities. Of course, we want to help the people who are unsheltered right now. We've got to chew gum and walk at the same time, is what I keep saying. We have to figure out what we can do for folks now and what we are going to do for folks in the future. I myself have had some experiences being unsheltered, and so I bring that lived experience to this committee, and I know that I am in a place of privilege, and that my experience is not like most of the people in my district who are unsheltered, but I do remember what it feels like to feel like every question and every request for help is a burden on someone else, and that feeling of uncertainty and just loneliness. And so I'm hoping that we really get to hear from some folks who are experiencing this firsthand, because I think that's important and integral to the work that we're going to be doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Representative Hornstein.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to be with you members this morning. My name is Frank Hornstein. I represent District 61A, which includes parts of downtown and southwest Minneapolis. This issue has been really raised to the forefront in the area I represent in recent months. We have had many encampments in the community around this part of Minneapolis. And Madam Chair, I know I've said this and I'll say it again publicly, your role this summer in helping to address this issue, I think really serves as an example for how we as legislators can respond proactively when different agencies were pointing fingers at each other and nothing was happening. You took on this issue of encampments and brought people together, not just in government, but community organizations and foundations. And we started something called the Indoor Villages concept. And again, I just hold that up as an example of what we can do as legislators in our own communities, even beyond specific pieces of legislation. I also represent in the area I represent is an institution called the Bridge for Youth, which is a fantastic organization that has worked on youth homelessness actually for several decades. And it's a model that I hope that can be replicated in many other communities. It provides not only shelter, but a safe space, counseling services, other services that these youth are in desperate need of, and family reunification. And in addition to that, I have a personal connection to something called the Steve O'Neill Apartments in Duluth. My friend and mentor in community organizing, Steve O'Neill, it was named for him of blessed memory. He passed away in 2013, but he worked a lot with the homeless. And this particular institution in Duluth also provides transitional housing with wraparound services. And it's my hope that we can look at that as a model that could be replicated throughout the state. And finally, Madam Chair, I like the fact that this is called the Preventing Homelessness Committee. Another issue in the area I represent, which has been really around for a couple of decades, but again, we're seeing an acceleration in the conversion of existing housing, market rate housing, affordable housing into market rate housing. And that has put tremendous pressure on affordability, and I think it's been a cause of homelessness. So really addressing affordable housing is part and parcel of, I think, our work. So thank you, members and Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Hornstein. I'm not sure if Representative Howard has joined us. I didn't mention that he did reach out to me, and he's on legislative business today, so don't think he's here. Next we'll hear from Representative Erin Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Erin Cagle, I represent 37A, which is Blaine, Coon Rapids, Spring Lake Park. And one of the reasons that I wanted to be on this committee was, I know you, the transportation folks that were on the committee last year, we did a North Metro tour. And so you guys all have been to my neighborhood and, seen my house. And I live right across the street from a shopping mall and a transit center. And when I'm laying in my bed, there's people across the street sleeping in their cars. People in the park by my house, sleeping next to the warming houses. And, I live in the suburbs. And so this isn't just something that affects people in Minneapolis and St. Paul. This is something that affects people everywhere. And so, I really want to understand what the difference is, and how people get to that point and what we can do to prevent it. And I think that's, it's amazing that we have this preventing homelessness. So much of our work is reactionary. And so it would be really nice to be proactive and make sure that people don't have to be in those situations that, me laying in my warm bed, that there's not somebody across the street sleeping in their cold car. And so that's just really, one of the reasons that I wanted to be on this committee. And I'm really looking forward to the work that we're going to dive in and do together. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Representative Cagle. Representative John Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm representing 24A, which is down in Oatana-Wauseka, south of here. Some of you may or may not know that for 21 years, I had been a church administrator. And now I'm not an ordained pastor. I was the executive person in dealing with budgets, but I dealt a lot with emergencies and needs and dealing with individuals as they were migrating through our community and within our community for various household and homelessness needs. And so one of the things that became very apparent was that this is certainly not a easy, simple answer. It's very complex. There are many reasons for where people are at and a lot of decisions that were made based upon them. And so for a couple of things, I really want to make sure that we kind of deal with. One of them is, I appreciate you bringing in people that are homeless. I think that's important. However, I think where we will find the most information for us are those that were successful in going from homeless to where they have now a home. Most of people have their own paradigms based upon their historical information and knowledge and education. And oftentimes it's hard for us to go beyond those paradigms to see solutions that are without our own vision. And so it's important to get additional ones. And the other one, which I think is even more critical and a concern that I have, is at the end of this COVID crisis and the elimination of all of the protections, we have a potential of a huge increase in the number of homeless people as they get evicted from their shelter and other things because they haven't paid rent. And it's going to not only put them in a homeless situation, it's going to deteriorate their credit ratings and ability to get homes elsewhere. And it's an indication where sometimes unintended consequences of what we do can have even dire effects into the future. So there are some things that we need to kind of look at as to see, you know, what we're going to move forward with, and also to be careful about how our policies that we have can impact various groups of people in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Petersburg. Finally, Representative Liz Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's great to be here. This is a committee of the heart for me at a couple of different levels. And one is at a personal level. I've had experience myself with housing instability when I was younger. And I know how disorienting it is, but also the ripple down effects into all other aspects of life. And more recently, my son, who I'm sharing this with his permission, is a disabled veteran. And he just last month finally found shelter. So it cuts very close to the heart for me. At the same time, on the policy side, it's very close to me because it's a place where we look at the complexity, and so many of you have acknowledged that. And I love hearing the points of view from my colleagues here, because no one is looking at us as a simple problem. And that gives us so much opportunity to be successful. Just one example that comes to mind is if you look at the intersection between homelessness and healthcare. I'm on the healthcare committee, the health committee as well. Homelessness can be caused by healthcare-related issues. Think about bankruptcy and the effect of not being able to work because you have a condition and you don't have the care you need. That can be the trigger that drives homelessness. At the same time, you're homeless, that drives poor health outcomes. So everything is interrelated. Look across the board at housing and any type of policy area. And we're here in a position to be able to address that and to deal with that and to say what's connected to which, again, to avoid unintended consequences and to, which is one of my favorite phrases. So thank you, Representative Petersburg. So to be able to do that. In Dakota County, we have some similar situations. We do have people who are homeless. We have quite a lot who are couch surfing homeless or living in hotels, a substantial increase in shelter beds with COVID. But I worry a great deal about the foreclosure and eviction crisis that's looming. And even before COVID, we had an affordability problem in my county where rents and housing prices are increasing and real income is going down. We have about 9,500 extremely low income households in the county, and we have less than 3,000 affordable units. I mean, so there's a fundamental mismatch that's been going on. So I look to this committee to address both the immediate issues that we're facing and helping the people who need help today, this minute, as well as the preventive approach to help us make it a safer place and a place where more people can have that warm bed and the roof over their house. So thank you all. I appreciate being here.
Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. So next, we're going to hear briefly from the staff that will be on this journey with us. I'm going to call on each of you, and if you could just share briefly your role on the committee, and if there's anything, you know, we are all doing this work together as people. So if there's, you know, anything that you want to contribute about, you know, your thoughts about this issue or any experience that that informs your work. I would love to hear that also. So we'll start with Sean Herring.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Sean Herring. I'm the committee administrator. I asked to be part of this committee. I was really excited that I'm going to be working with all of you. Just really briefly, I think the thing that informs me and that I can't stop thinking about as we're starting to do this. My friend, one of my best friends, she worked at one of the Minneapolis nonprofits here. She was really passionate about this. Her father struggled with homelessness. He struggled with addiction. He struggled with a lot of things. And a few years ago, I remember I was with her the day that her dad died outside. He died unsheltered. And she had, you know, she worked every single day. She worked really hard on this. And she just couldn't stop saying he died outside. He couldn't get in. He died outside. And so I think Representative New Brindley brought up a really important point about spinning wheels, because I think, like, there are a bunch of amazing people who do a bunch of amazing work, and it's not for lack of passion, but if there's an inefficiency in the system, if there's an inefficiency in all of the people who are doing this work, that systemic inefficiency that we see at the legislative level, on the individual level, is just countless personal tragedies, not just for the people who are outside, but for the people who care about them and love them. And so that's something that I think is really just important to keep in mind in the work that we're doing, and I hope we can do a bunch of amazing things here. So I'm really excited to work with all of you.
Thanks, Sean. Kevin Petrie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Petrie. I'm the Committee Legislative Assistant. I'm just excited to support everybody in the work that we're doing on this committee. It's an incredibly important committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Molly Peterson.
Hi, thank you everyone. I'm Molly Peterson. I am new to House DFL research, and I'm really honored to be on this committee. I think it's just been really wonderful to hear all of your personal passions for this, and I'm happy to support your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Glantz, I hope I'm saying your name right.
Very close. Bill Galan. I'm a GOP researcher for the committee, supporting the GOP caucus. I've been with the caucus since 2015, and I'm looking forward to this session.
Thank you. I'll get it right next time. Randall Chun.
Madam Chair, I'm Randy Chun with House Research. I normally cover issues related to state healthcare programs and healthcare access, but I'll be staffing this division whenever Danielle Pinelli, who is the analyst in our office who does have, you know, substantive knowledge of homeless issues, is not able to attend. And I think, as you know, there's a conflict between this division and the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee, which Danielle also staffs.
Thank you. Ken Savory.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ken Savory, the nonpartisan fiscal staff assigned to this division. And I think, as many of you mentioned, this issue does touch a lot of areas. And because of that, I'll be kind of triaging and using various other fiscal staff as we move through different topics throughout the committee. So I'll be coordinating with various people in human services and economic development and other areas as well. Looking forward to working with you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That concludes our introductions of the team that's going to be working on this. And I think if there was any doubt about the statements that I made at the beginning in my introduction about us being the right people to do this work, that those were allayed in hearing all of your reflections and all of your thoughts. I just, like, Representative Ryer and Representative New Brindley both said, like, this is like heart work. This is emotional work, and hearing that in all of your statements, sort of the compassion and thoughtfulness and recognition of the nuance and complication that's here, just really very moving to me. And so I'm really grateful for that introduction. Thank you so much. So next we have a presentation by the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. The Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, they'll go through, you know, what they do, but it's comprised of 11 state agencies, the Met Council and the Governor's Office, and is responsible for leading the state's efforts to achieve housing stability for all Minnesotans. We'll have plenty of time for members to ask questions after the presentation, but for now, if we could just hold them until the end, that would be great. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kathy Tenbrook and her team to introduce themselves and proceed with their presentation.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair Gomez, Vice Chair Keeler, and all the committee members. I am just incredibly honored to be here, and really, it was wonderful to meet all of you through those introductions. I found it very moving as well, Chair Gomez. And after 27 years of working on this issue, it's hard to express how grateful I am to have a committee in the House that is focused on this. So thank you for your attention to this issue that you've all said so eloquently is so important for so many goals that we have as a state, whether it's educational achievement or building a stronger workforce or improving health. So thank you for that. I want to introduce my team who's here today to present to you. First of all, I'll just share that my name is Kathy Tenbrook. I am the executive director of our Interagency Council on Homelessness here at the state. I am also an assistant commissioner over at Minnesota Housing. And I have been working on homelessness my entire adult life, which is now about 27 years, starting back in the early 90s at St. Stephen's Homeless Shelter in Minneapolis, where I worked for 8 years in direct service. And that has guided every one of my days since. It's the most meaningful work I've ever done. And then I went on to work in policy at all levels of government, county, federal, and state. Went out to the United States Interagency Council during the Obama administration for a short stint there. And then came back and took this role in January of 2013 with the goal of creating a cabinet level body that could really look at the issue of preventing and ending homelessness across multiple systems. All the ways that you have all talked about the interconnectedness of issues and the complicated nature of this work, the solutions lie there as well. And so it has been really an honor to be able to pull together this cabinet level body, which I will give much more detail about in just a moment. But before I go there, I want to introduce my other team members. Eric Grumdahl, he is the deputy director of the Interagency Council. And Eric comes with decades of experience as well in this work. He was also out at the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, and I essentially stole him back home where he had worked previously to help lead the work on ending veteran homelessness. And we have had some tremendous success in that area, which I'm sure many of you know. More to do, absolutely, but he was really responsible for helping us develop a system here in Minnesota that could focus on ending veteran homelessness, and also recently working with the Department of Education on Homework Starts with Home and bringing student homelessness to light and providing support for families with children in schools. Elizabeth Dressel, shortly before COVID hit, Elizabeth joined our team from the Public Housing Authority. But prior to that, she was also at the governor's office under Governor Dayton and worked to staff the governor's Affordable Housing Task Force. Elizabeth is our implementation specialist and equity coordinator for the council. And so just wanted you to know who the folks are that you'll be hearing from today. And we really look forward to being a resource to this committee in any way you need us. And so with that, we'll go to the next slide. So the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, I'm not sure how many of you know even that it exists. And so I wanted to just spend a moment to tell you that we do now have, since 2013, a cabinet level body here at the state. It is led by the Lieutenant Governor. It is currently co-chaired by our Housing Commissioner and the Commissioner of Human Services. But it has all of the commissioners of these agencies that sit on that council. They meet quarterly, and they're supported by a very robust team of senior leaders throughout these agencies and many policy and program specialists within the agencies. And we work with them every day and our partners all across the state to focus on the work that we're doing to prevent and end homelessness. And this has really been a recognition of the fact that no one entity, no one agency has what it needs to prevent and end homelessness. But bringing all of these multiple mainstream resources together is really what will help create the kind of stability we're looking for in our goal and our vision that we could create housing stability for all Minnesotans. Every single one of these agencies has a role in that in some way. And I think as Chair Gomez said better than I can, it's also very much focused on the fact that if we do nothing, if we don't address homelessness, the costs are enormously high. It prevents us from achieving these goals that we have as a state around equity and educational outcomes and workforce development, health. But it also has, you know, real cost for the future for children, youth, families who are experiencing the trauma of homelessness, and enormously huge costs for our healthcare system and other big systems as well. So I think the recognition that this is critical, not just for people experiencing homelessness, although that is the entire goal of this entity, but for all of us across the state of Minnesota. Next slide, please. We have been, and I should back up from 2013. I really do want to make the point that addressing homelessness in Minnesota in our history has been a bipartisan issue with bipartisan support. Under Governor Pawlenty, we launched a plan during his administration that was focused on creating permanent supportive housing for people who were homeless for a long period of time and also had disabilities. And that plan created over 3,000 new housing opportunities for people who had been homeless that we call chronically homeless, so homeless a long time plus disabilities. And building on that work, during the Dayton administration and now the Walz administration, we have launched statewide plans not only focused on ending chronic homelessness, but also focused on ending veteran homelessness, youth homelessness, family and children homelessness as well. And so these are statewide plans with statewide engagement. This most recent iteration on the far right, Heading Home Together, is a plan that recognizes that even as a state, with all of those agencies involved, we cannot do this alone. We need our private and public partners and nonprofit partners and entities in every corner of the state to help in this work. Over 1,000 Minnesotans helped create this plan that we have been, that has been guiding our work over the last few years. And during the pandemic, we had to put the planning for our next iteration of the plan on hold, as you can imagine, and we'll talk a little bit about our work during COVID. But we are working this year, taking everything we've learned from our experience with the pandemic to work with our partners across the state to create our next statewide plan. Next slide, please. So the statewide plan focuses on our strategies and actions on achieving these seven principles. These are the things that really guide our work on a daily basis. Overarching all of this is the work around prevention. As you've all mentioned, prevention is of course the first and foremost goal of all of those agencies and the work that we do to keep people stably housed. But we also know that there are some really key ingredients, and we've learned a lot over these several decades of what it takes to end homelessness. These are the principal ingredients that drive that work. One is that we need to know, you know, who people are. We need to be able to identify everybody experiencing homelessness. That was one of the key ingredients in our work on ending veteran homelessness, was literally to know every veteran in the state we could find by name, understand what they needed, and help connect them to the right resource that would work for them. The second one around providing some form of shelter immediately. And I know all of you have been paying attention. This is a challenging one. We do not have the shelter capacity statewide to ensure this right now. And this is a principle that's very important to help people move from the streets into a safe and stable place while they are getting connected. Linking people experiencing homelessness with housing and services that are tailored to their needs. So really working directly with people experiencing homelessness, understanding what they need, understanding what will work for them, and getting them connected to that housing that will end their homelessness. Assisting people as quickly as possible into permanent housing, using a person-centered approach. You'll hear that word a lot from us. And also a housing-first approach. This was really a paradigm shift in our work over the last several years. And essentially what housing first means is that it means that instead of telling the person, hey, we're going to try to help you get housing, but first you need to be sober or be on your medications or do this and that, it removes those barriers and says what we understand is that getting people housing first is the most important thing they need in order to take care of all of those other issues that may be impacting their lives. And using that model, not just here, but nationally, that has been one of the biggest drivers in getting people who were homeless, in some cases for decades, out of homelessness and into housing. helping people experiencing homelessness increase their employment and their incomes, and then organizing all of our work across the state, whether it's public, you know, partners across the state, bringing in philanthropy in the private sector, all of our systems to be able to do this on an ongoing basis. So these are essentially these distilled ingredients that we know we need to have in place if we're going to be successful. Next slide, please. And then just very quickly, I thought it would be helpful to all of you, just by way of definition of what do we mean when we say we are going to end homelessness or prevent homelessness. After working on this for so many years, I've had a lot of people look at me very skeptically and say, how in the world do you think you could possibly end homelessness? And I just want to be really clear that by ending homelessness, we do not mean that no one ever again will have a housing crisis. We do not mean that, you know, people won't sometimes fall into housing instability. But what we do mean is that we do have the power and the ability to create a system in our state that can prevent homelessness more often, prevent it whenever humanly possible. And if somebody does fall into homelessness, we can have a more rapid response to make sure that we're quickly getting people out of homelessness and to making sure that they don't fall back in. So this graphic you're going to see here just sort of illustrates this concept for you. So this picture shows you that, of course, at any given time in the gray zone there, there are a number of episodes of homelessness. We certainly have new people falling into homelessness very regularly. Obviously, you know, an economic crisis, a health crisis, bringing people into the state of homelessness. We also have people leaving homelessness, which is, of course, the ultimate outcome, getting into stable housing, which is great. However, we also have many people returning. So that bottom line on the blue line, you see people cycling back into homelessness all over again because they don't always have the supports that they need for the long term to remain stably housed. So ending homelessness means that we are preventing new homelessness whenever we possibly can, the new incidents. And that's by doing things like, you know, our COVID housing assistance program and other programs that are really making sure that we're not allowing people to fall into homelessness. We're making homelessness rare by increasing the number of housing outcomes that we can achieve, how many housing opportunities there are, and you're going to hear in a minute about some of the challenges we have in terms of our housing market as it relates to this issue. We're making every episode of homelessness as brief as we possibly can. So we're identifying that family, we're quickly getting them connected to what they need and out, because homelessness is traumatic and it has long-term impacts on children and everybody. And then really critically important, we're making sure the right kinds of supports and protections are in place to make sure that people don't fall back into homelessness. So what we mean when we say end homelessness is that we have created a system in our state that works like this. And the work on veteran homelessness is probably our very best example. You know, we had bipartisan federal support for new housing resources that created a lot more housing opportunity. It was linked to the services and supports that those veterans needed through their VA system and others. And we were able to achieve this very kind of system so far in 6 of the 10 regions of our state. So we've essentially ended veteran homelessness by this definition in 6 of the 10 major regions of our state. And so it's a proof point that we know how to do this. We know it's possible. We can do the same thing for youth, for families with children, and for people who've been, you know, chronically homeless, have co-occurring health conditions, and are sleeping outside. So with that, I want to turn it over to my deputy, Eric Grumdahl, to walk through a little bit of the state of homelessness and the data to help you get grounded in that as we go forward.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you, Chair Gomez and members. My name is Eric Grumdahl. As Kathy mentioned, I'm the deputy director of the Interagency Council on Homelessness. And so in painting kind of a context and using the data that we have to really help us understand housing instability and homelessness in Minnesota, we want to kind of cover a number of data sets that help us kind of get our arms around this kind of the scale and the dynamics of this challenge, starting really with the broadest frame, which is the number of Minnesotans that are struggling to sustain their housing because of the dramatic shortage of affordable housing. And so across the state, over 500,000 households are facing what's defined as kind of cost-burdened housing. They have to spend at more than 30% of their income, which by federal terms means that housing is unaffordable. They're spending more than 30% of their income on their housing. And we see that for low-income households in particular, they're spending, a large number of them are not only cost-burdened, so 4 out of 5 are cost-burdened, but 61% are severely cost-burdened, meaning that they are spending, with the lowest incomes of any household, they are spending more than 50% of that income toward housing. And so the context in which homelessness exists is in this kind of challenge of a market and affordable housing continuum that really does not have sufficient options for people that are at the lowest incomes. The graph on the left side of your slide also shows kind of another way to look at this, which is just the literal shortage of units that are affordable compared to the number of renters at the lowest incomes that are seeking those units. And some of that is about the fact that there just simply aren't enough units to begin with. That's compounded by the fact that the people that are in the units that are most affordable are not always the households with the lowest income. And so what we see is a really dramatic gap and substantial, massive competition for the incomes that are affordable for people, for the units that are affordable for people at the lowest incomes. And so Minnesotans are resilient, but many, many Minnesotans are hanging on to their housing now by a thread. And this is all data that was prior to the pandemic, of course. And so lots of additional impacts that we can imagine from all of the economic turmoil that's come with the pandemic. So we're going to cover some other data sets that help us kind of zoom in on specific populations of Minnesotans experiencing homelessness. And it's important to note that there's a variety of ways that homelessness is defined in statute and congressionally, often tied to specific programs that are really using those definitions to target their resources or supports. And so these numbers, the slides that you're about to see, use different ways to understand the dynamic. And what we really lean on those analyses to do is to have many vantage points on the same problem. And so the next set of information here that I'll present is the annual point in time count. This is a federally mandated count that occurs all across the country, led by these continuum of care regions. Kathy mentioned that 6 of our continuum of care regions have confirmed with the federal government that they've ended veteran homelessness. Minnesota has a total of 10. Those COCs organize a variety of volunteers and other data collection efforts to go out and identify every person they can experiencing homelessness on a single night statewide. Since 2015, that count has really been coordinated at a statewide level. So we're really trying to get comparable data across all 10 of those COCs. And what this really shows us is not just the trend for homelessness overall in Minnesota and for specific subpopulations, but this gives us a data set that we can also compare to other jurisdictions across the country. It's important to note that homelessness really manifests not just as an urban problem, and I think that's one of the misperceptions of the issue that we often confront, and I know you've spoken to that in part of your introductions. 34% of the Minnesotans that were identified in the most recent point in time count in January were identified outside of the metro area, so just over a third. I guess the other piece that I'll just share here is that I think what these data help us do is really see the ways in which there are places we are making progress. We've seen an overall reduction since the first Heading Home plan was adopted. In the number of people that were counted in the point in time count, we've seen a pretty significant reduction in the number of people and families, but we've also seen, not just in the most recent count and not just during the pandemic, we've also seen some troubling increases for other subpopulations that are a focus here, the most dramatic of which, of course, are the number of people in Minnesota staying outside. This really follows a trend that has been observed really in communities across the country, but it's been a multi-year kind of increase up more than 145% since 2014. So pretty remarkable increase, which has motivated a lot of focus and effort on that population even before the pandemic hit. The other thing that the point in time count data and other data sets allow us to do is really to look at some of the key drivers that inform who's experiencing homelessness, that shape who's experiencing homelessness, and therefore inform our efforts to respond. This is a dramatic depiction of the racial and ethnic disparities we see in who confronts homelessness in Minnesota. And for us, this is the smoking gun that points to the significant impact of racism and racial inequality in driving the ongoing kind of experience of who faces homelessness. Many Minnesotans, as we just saw, face poverty, face maybe precarious housing situations. This is a dramatic depiction of who experiences homelessness specifically. So each of the line graphs depicts a racial population. These are ratios relative to white Minnesotans. And so what you see is that compared to the general population, we do start to see some disparities in terms of which racial groups experience poverty in Minnesota, but those explode when we come to homelessness, particularly for Native Minnesotans and African-American Minnesotans, and further spread when we come to Minnesotans who are experiencing not just homelessness, but are staying outside, are unsheltered. So we view this as being a really critical ingredient in how we need to shape our response to homelessness. We are also lucky in Minnesota in that a partnership between six tribal governments and the Wilder Research Center has produced really the only of its kind that we're aware of, this ongoing longitudinal look at homelessness and near homelessness on reservations, which is often kind of an underappreciated, underanalyzed, not as visible kind of dimension of homelessness. And what I think that report really does a remarkable job of doing is confronting some of the misperceptions of Native homelessness that often kind of confound the ability to understand the situation. So the fact that while many people who experience homelessness on reservations are in a doubled up situation, that's neither a choice and often is very tenuous. So lots of volatility in where people end up staying. People often end up staying in places that that are either overcrowded or are in some way substandard. And so I think another important lens on both homelessness and frankly, the kind of housing affordability challenges for reservation communities across our state. This next picture, I think, also helps really make the point that many of you have spoken to already, members, about the wide distribution of homelessness. This is school-reported data. Every October, on October 1st, students are identified who are experiencing homelessness, and that information gets reported up to the state. And so what we see is that in the most recent data that's available from October of 2019, so again, pre-pandemic, we saw that students experiencing homelessness were identified in schools across 77 of Minnesota's 87 counties. And so the dots on the map reflect a school where an individual student has been identified in those counts. And we see the same kinds of disproportionality in which students experience homelessness that we see in the point in time count data. The last piece that I'll just highlight here, I think, is also a nice way to set the stage for our understanding of the pandemic response. And it speaks to some of the factors, the complicating factors that many of you have spoken to in your introductions around the challenges that people experiencing homelessness are facing at the same time that they're confronting housing instability. And so this picture from the Wilder Research Center, this is part of their triennial survey of people experiencing homelessness, depicts the overlap for homeless adults of serious mental illness, substance abuse disorder, and chronic physical health conditions. And I think the overlap is really important to appreciate because there are many Minnesotans who face mental health issues or face substance abuse issues, not all of whom experience homelessness. These are really compounding and complicating factors for Minnesotans that are in the midst of a housing crisis, also needing to confront what are often multiple of these barriers at the same time that they're trying to find their path back into housing. And so we view this as being not only a really critical way to inform the response that's needed, but certainly is the reason that we were very concerned about Minnesotans experiencing homelessness in the context of the pandemic. And for that, I'm gonna turn this over to my colleague, Elizabeth, who's gonna walk through some of our pandemic response.
Thanks so much, Eric and Chair Gomez and members. I'm Elizabeth Dressel, and as Kathy mentioned, I'm the Implementation Specialist and Equity Coordinator with the Interagency Council on Homelessness. And Eric, you can go to the next slide. So I'm, as Eric was mentioning, we knew from a lot of that data really needing to have a focused and robust response to the COVID-19 pandemic for people experiencing homelessness. And so that response sits inside of a larger response structure out of the governor's office. And Eric, you can move on for me, which is focused through this governor's at-risk populations work group that is co-chaired by Kathy and Dan Pollack from the Department of Human Services, really having a focused approach on people experiencing homelessness and other populations that you can see here on your slide. And this is where the response work has been happening at the state level. We can go on to the next slide, please. And so one major thing that has been a part of the response is new resources that have been made available from both the state and federal government to support the COVID response for people experiencing homelessness. So this slide outlines those dollar amounts and sources for you. But these investments were really crucial in supporting the work that needed to be done to restructure our existing homeless response system. So sites needed to decompress, which means they needed to spread folks out to allow for appropriate social distancing. So moving either all of their shelter guests into hotel units to keep people safe, or high-risk older adults into those units. Operating shelters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, was really a key component, because especially during the stay-at-home order in the spring, there was no place else that was safe for folks to be. And so shelters extended their operating hours to be that safe space and allow people to be there during the daytime hours. You'll see there the $100 million in federal funds that the state dedicated to housing stability and eviction prevention through the COVID-19 Housing Assistance Program. And as many of you mentioned in your openings, just that was really targeted on slowing an influx of folks into homelessness by providing needed assistance to stay either in their rental or homes through financial support. So really all of these investments helped us help folks on the ground, local partners, really adapt and protect people quickly. If you want to move to the next slide for me, Eric. So really when we think about our pandemic response and really our general homelessness response, the state's role has been one of a convener of people, bringing people together, consolidating best practices and resources and information, and as a funder. We played this role in the pandemic. In the past year, the state team has really worked to bring people together through extensive outreach, one-on-one technical assistance with our providers. We've got a team of MDH staff who are really excellent providing one-on-one consultation as staff or cases were happening. They were developing guidance specific to homeless settings for folks staying outside. This all worked to help, you can see some of those key strategies on the left hand of the screen there, really allowed providers to keep people safe quickly in partnership with local communities. Local governments and organizations have stood up over 2,800 temporary shelter options, many in hotel units, some in congregate settings, have helped cover additional needs for staffing, personal protective equipment, making sure there's food at all of these locations, hot meals being delivered into encampments. This work has happened all across our state. When we think about, you know, some examples, in Rochester, they partnered with their local library system and their providers and county government to stand up a warming center during the day and overnight shelter space at their civic center. There are some providers who decided to work together in open collaborative hotel spaces so that they could consolidate their resources and staff efforts to protect folks in those spaces. Victim service providers have stood up hotel units to have immediate spaces for people fleeing violence and have a safe space to be. There's been different things stood up, hand washing and shower stations at encampments across the state, providing meals to those encampments. I think over 1,000 meals provided in the metro every week. So really shows that this response was a collective effort to really make sure people had the resources to help people stay safe from this crisis. And so when we think about, Kathy was mentioning earlier, we've been thinking a lot about key learnings and things that we can take away from this as we think about the work moving forward into beyond COVID times. And some of the things that I think come to our mind when we, as examples of things we've been starting to think about, is just, as Chair Gomez was mentioning in her opening remarks about, like,
needing an accountability structure to have really clearly defined roles and responsibilities. Some of our other systems in this response, the public health system or emergency management, are set up to manage crises and have real clear chains of accountability and function very quickly in this type of pandemic response, where our homeless response system is not quite set up in that same model to clearly delineate roles and responsibilities. And so there's opportunity for us to continue to work on that, as well as the partnerships across those systems weren't always talking. You know, local public health and the emergency management folks might not have known who their homeless service providers were in their counties. And so building those relationships and continuing that those connections moving forward will be important. Another thing we think about is, you know, the ability to be creative and rapidly deploy solutions. We've worked really quickly and many times throughout this pandemic to do things that maybe people didn't think were possible. A real concrete example of that was in some of the civil unrest in the metro area after George Floyd's murder. A group of partners, nonprofit partners, local, county, state government came together and rapidly, within a day, brought folks inside into safe hotel spaces and on a path to permanent housing. And so there's ways that this response has shown us the ability to be creative and work together very, very quickly that we want to carry forward into our work. Eric, you can go on to the next slide for me. And so when we think about all of those investments, we really feel like all of the work that our partners have done to protect people has really helped keep people safe. We've seen pretty relatively low case rates, especially at the beginning of the pandemic. This graph is showing you our case rates over time, broken out by staff, sheltered and unsheltered. We have just a little bit over 900 people experiencing homelessness and staff who've been tested positive for COVID since the beginning of the pandemic. When we were looking at initial EPI data, we were seeing that there could be, we could see really worst case scenario, high rates of infection in our sites and thinking that we could get to thousands of cases very quickly. Thankfully, our cases have stayed well below our worst case scenarios. And many of our colleagues have attributed that to our collective and rapid response targeted towards protecting people experiencing homelessness and being able to have systems and structures in place to intercept outbreaks as best we could over the summer. But what we've seen, what you'll see kind of on that, the peak on that graph, and what we've seen is how rapidly cases can get out of control, which is what we've seen in November. We saw a vast increase in cases in a very short amount of time. So we know that these resources and this collaborative approach and targeted approach and this response has really protected folks. And continuing to sustain that is gonna be critically important until we can get everyone vaccinated. Eric, the next slide for me just even really highlights why we even think about how important this is into the overall response when we think about the burden on healthcare systems. Is this graph indicates the disproportionate rates that people experiencing homelessness are needing hospital level of care and ICU care. They are more vulnerable to severe illness. And so that red bar on the top is showing the Minnesota population generally of folks who've been diagnosed with COVID, the blue for sheltered and the green for unsheltered at the time of their diagnosis of COVID. So for unsheltered population, over 20% are needing hospitalization and are four times more likely to end up in the ICU. And that rate just increases where it's nearly half of the unsheltered population has needed hospitalization and are seven times more likely to need ICU level of care. And so, you know, like we were saying, those pre-existing health conditions and other impacts make them vulnerable to severe illness. And so if we were to see continued outbreaks in our settings, it could really put an immense burden on the healthcare systems and hospital space. And so knowing that what we have done has really helped keep some of those outbreaks at bay is really continuing to keep this structure in place, really making sure we've got protective spaces and resources for folks to stay safe and that we don't overburden the larger response system. And so with that, I'm gonna turn it back over to Kathy.
Great, and I'm just gonna close this out with one more comment before we take questions, which is, I think our hope, and I'm sorry, I know it felt like rapid fire information, but our hope is just to start with some grounding information for all of you as best we could on the data that we have and what we know about this work right now. And hopefully that really just adds to so much of the knowledge and expertise that many of you also have. And I want to just add that there are so many places within all of this work where we could take much deeper dives together. And we would be honored to come back and provide deeper information on any one of the topics, whether it's, you know, specific populations you're interested in, solutions to homelessness in terms of the innovations and opportunities we see ahead, you know, the intersectionality of the issues, more on prevention, more on shelter funding. So there's many ways we could go, and I just wanted to thank you for your time, and we're happy to answer questions if there are any.
Great. Thank you so much, Director Tenbrook, and to your team. We really appreciate it. So we were maybe a little over optimistic with our time today, but we do have time for a couple of questions if anybody has some. As Kathy mentioned, you know, we're collaborators with this crew, and so this is the first of many conversations we'll have in this committee with them. And also, if there are other questions you have, you know, Sean and our researchers can help coordinate that. I'm just going to try to see if there's anybody's hand. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Tenbrook. I've appreciated your work so much over so many years, and it's wonderful to see you in this role. I believe this was from Mr. Grumdahl's slide, and if not, maybe the appropriate person who showed it. But there was 145% increase in people sleeping outdoors since 2014. And, you know, I know that there was some survey data from Minneapolis over the summer as to the reasons for that. But I'm wondering if you could discuss perhaps the reasons why we've had such an increase like that. And apparently that trend continues.
Great. I'm happy to start and invite my colleagues to weigh in as well, or anyone. You know, I think at its core, Representative Hornstein, that's an issue, goes back to the issue at the very beginning we talked about in terms of housing. As our housing market has gotten farther and farther out of reach for so many Minnesotans and become more competitive, the folks who are the very least likely to be able to access permanent stable housing are folks that are not only at very, very low incomes, of course, but also have any other kinds of complicating co-occurring issues in their lives that make them less able to compete for the housing that's available. I would also say that the kind of housing that we have available often is not the housing that will work best for folks who are sleeping outside. So one of the things you sometimes might hear is, oh, you know, people are choosing to be homeless. You know, they're not ready for housing. And what we really like to kind of remind people is that we very deeply believe, after lots of years of work, that there is not a single person that's not ready for housing. It's that the housing that we have is not ready for them. And so trying to use really person-centered approaches to figuring out the kinds of housing that will be more innovative, that will be more, you know, thoughtful to the needs of people who are actually sleeping on the streets. So very low barrier housing, something we often call harm reduction, which is housing where people can enter housing, even with all of the complicating factors going on in their lives, and be supported to be safe with dignity, even if those issues still exist for them. So that's my quick. There's a lot more probably to say there, but Eric or Elizabeth, anyone else want to add?
Thanks, Kathy. I think the only other thing that I would add, Representative Hornstein, is just that I think most Minnesotans would be surprised to learn that our shelter system and the funding for shelter has never kept pace with the demand. And so the concept that shelters are typically full, operating at full capacity without having enough spaces for everybody who needs them is obviously an important ingredient there too.
And maybe just to put a fine point on that last piece, you know, when we launched all of the protective spaces during COVID, the legislature very thankfully immediately provided about $26.5 million for us to do that work across the state to stand up those spaces and to really protect people. And that, Eric, what's our budget at the Department of Human Services annually before that for shelters statewide?
Less than $1 million.
So we could go to scale and we could do what we did, but on a typical year, you know, we have less than $1 million statewide for all shelter systems. So it's a resource challenge for sure.
Thank you so much for that. We're just going to take one more question from Representative Petersburg and then move on to the community members who wanted to testify today. And as I said, this is the beginning of our conversation. And so, you know, we'll have more opportunities to interface with Kathy and Eric and their team. Rep. Petersburg?
Thank you so much. This is a quick clarifying question. Me being a numbers guy, whenever I see comparison between percentages, I like to verify that we're talking about apples to apples. And earlier in the session, in the presentation, there was a comparison that rents grew 21%, but incomes grew 3% adjusted for inflation. Do we know if the rent was also adjusted for inflation?
Representative Petersburg and Chair Gomez, both of those figures were adjusted for inflation, and they're included as part of the Minnesota Housing annual housing affordability analysis posted on their website.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify, we were talking apples to apples. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Rep. Petersburg, for your question, and we'll be digging into the data more, right? So finally, we've had two people sign up for public testimony. First, excuse me, we're going to hear from Joe Nathan. Ready to go? Mr. Nathan, you can go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I know there's only a few minutes left, so I want to say three quick things. First, the number of us around the state who have grave concerns about the information that you've just been presented. Secondly, we think there are innovative solutions that have not been fully explored. And we recognize that with only 5 minutes left, there's not time to fully get into this. So I will just proceed briefly. First, you heard that there were about 9,000 students who were homeless, and that's far more than the number of students in the point of time. What you did not hear was that if you talk with school district officials, you would be told throughout the state, district and charter public school educators would tell you that the actual number of homeless youth is 2 to 3 times that 9,000. This has been a consistent problem, dramatic understating. Secondly, when the legislature was informed in 2019 that there was a significant problem of homelessness, this is pre-pandemic, the legislature responded with more than $3 million allocation, but a number of us raised considerable concern when we learned that not one new shelter bed was added in the metro area with more than $1.5 million. A lot of money was spent. It was spent on technical assistance. It was spent on helping improve what people who were working with homeless people knew. That was good. But I talk with many people working with homeless folks, people experiencing homelessness, were deeply concerned because the amount of shelters did not expand, even though the legislature allocated more than $1.5 million to be spent. There's more to say about that. Finally, we have spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the last 25 years on the shelter system. We have a huge system of sheltering in the state. As Ms. Tenbrook pointed out, we don't have enough truly affordable housing, and there's a lot more to say about that. But one of the things that several of us have been talking about for years is that in Anoka Hennepin, for example, school district, youngsters have been building for 20 years homes that could easily be built for high school for homeless people. They're building homes at less than $100,000 a year. We also have youth build programs all over the state where youngsters are learning construction skills and are at the same time either building homes or they're building or they're fixing up apartments that are tax forfeited. So we could be spending money far more efficiently, far more effectively in a win-win situation where we would have young people learning construction skills and at the same time taking existing structures that are not ready for people or constructing new things. Now, I realize that you're short on time, so I'd be glad to talk about this in further discussion. But these are three things that I hope your committee will take into account. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nathan. Our next testifier is Sue Wetlove Phillips.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for this opportunity to testify, and thank you for your opening comments. They were very touching, especially those of you that have been impacted by housing and the homeless crisis, as I was in the early 1970s as I trained for the Olympics and got hurt and lost my job, loading semis at UPS on a part-time job, lost my housing, and also lost the ability basically to take care of myself for a period of time and needed to move back home. As president of the National Coalition for the Homeless, current executive director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, which is made up of half of our board are people that have experienced homelessness, and 70% of our board are from diverse communities. Janelle Freeman Anderson is on our board from Freedom from the Streets, which we have been the fiscal agent for recently. The last couple of years, we're very pleased with that. MICA wants us to help create welcoming communities where we love and we treat other people the way that we'd want to be treated, and where everyone, without exception, has a safe, decent, accessible home that's affordable to them. So Sean has sent out to you some information that I put together on 5 decades of growing homelessness. So while for many people, COVID-19 kind of made homelessness, they became aware of homelessness because of the COVID-19. It's something that I've been working on with people experiencing homelessness for over 53 years, and especially since this new episode of growing homelessness over the last 5 decades since the late 1970s. 78% of the American population lives paycheck to paycheck. Half of the Americans are 1 to 3 paychecks away from not being able to make rent or mortgage payments. And so you can see a lot of the information that Eric had up on his slides are issues that are not only happening in Minnesota, but across the country. If you have money and you have a lot of different issues, whether it's mental health or chemical health or criminal records, you can be in housing. And I'm one of those people because I have all those other issues, but because I have money, I'm in housing. If you don't have money, it's gonna be hard for you to get into housing. If you don't have very much money and you have any of those issues in your background, it's going to be almost impossible for you to make it through background checks. So on the 2 sheets that you received from me, I'm just going to run through very quickly the 10 major system issues that we need to address. And I hope that you will invite me back again to continue this conversation with many of our homeless friends that have experienced homelessness. And before I go into those 10 just very briefly, is that we use the term experience homelessness because it's not who you are or who I am when you have experienced homelessness. It is a part of what your life has had and that people can move beyond that. So it's not about the homeless. It's about people that don't have a home for a period of time. We've had a limited moral outcry to love and treat others as ourselves. And oftentimes people experiencing homelessness are not at decision-making tables, including our Interagency Council on Homelessness, as well as many of our other providers and homeless service providers and continuum of cares. This is something that we need to make sure that people are at decision-making tables that are impacted. Greed is a major issue. We treat housing as a commodity instead of a basic need. With our budgets right now on the state level, we will spend more money, 4 to 5 times as much money subsidizing me as a homeowner as we will put into housing that's affordable for people with very limited income. We have very limited enforcement of our civil rights and fair housing laws. We do not create livable incomes, both in employment as well as in our public assistance programs. We've demolished a lot of housing. We have a lot of housing that are at risk of being converted right now because they are older units, and the landlords that are old like me, and I am a landlord also, are selling off their properties and they are using that money for their retirement. But then people are buying them and then they're upping the rents. We had the credit expansion in the 1970s, and so we have a lot of people running around with a lot of debt. We've had a disinvestment in opportunities across all of our different systems, scams in the housing market, and then the data mining has been a major issue since the 1980s in regards to really keeping people out of housing by background checks, criminal checks, and other ways, and really not updating those records so it gets in the way. So I think that we need to decide if we really want to prevent homelessness, we need to have all hands on deck of a whole systemic change within both Minnesota and on the national level, which we are working with on the national level with the new administration. So we need to decide, are we going to blame people for being homeless and just continue to create a massive homeless system? Or are we going to be responsible and live out our faith and our values by addressing the needs of people experiencing homelessness now, and then making the structural changes needed to bring our community, state, and nation home? That we really become a nation where everybody has a home, which was pretty typical in the 70s and earlier, so that a lot of most people could afford being a home, and that we daily live our pledge of allegiance to this country to be one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Hope you'll have me back again. I'd love to spend more time talking with you about each of those areas. And thank you for letting me join you today.
Thank you so much for your comments, Ms. Whatlove Phillips. We really appreciate the testimony that we heard today. And again, just my deepest gratitude to all of you on this meeting. I feel like everything that we talked about and every person who contributed to the conversation today really helped us to start building a shared understanding for our work together moving forward. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, January 20th at 10:30 a.m. on Zoom. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.